Our passage for today is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So some of my favorite stories in the gospel happen after Jesus' resurrection. I love, for example, the promise in Matthew's gospel that we looked at a few weeks ago. "Surely I am with you always to the end of the age," the very end of the age. I love in Luke's gospel how we see the resurrected Jesus eating fish. It's as if he's hungry in his resurrected body. And John's gospel is filled with some of the most memorable accounts of what happened after Jesus' resurrection. So we have Jesus' tender encounter with Mary at the tomb. We have Thomas putting his hand into Jesus' flesh that had been pierced and exclaiming, "My Lord and my God." And Peter, seeing the risen Jesus on the shoreline, dives into the lake, swims to the shoreline, where Jesus is waiting with a fire and serves them breakfast. I think that's so cool that Jesus serves them breakfast. And then there's Mark. If you noticed our reading today, we don't hear about any of those events in the passage in Mark. In Mark, we get these eight little verses. No appearances by the resurrected Jesus. No a great commissioning of the disciples. No ascension into heaven. I mean, really, we get less of a resurrection account in Mark and more of an empty tomb. We never encounter the risen Jesus. Now, if you're following along in your Bible, which I would encourage you, you will see some verses after verse 8. But most very likely, there should be something that breaks those up and says something like, "The earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16, 9 through 20. So we actually have two endings to Mark's gospel. There's the shorter one, which we heard, and then there's the longer one, which goes up into verse 20. And there's essentially universal agreement, basically, that I know of, that people have studied this, that Mark did not write the longer ending, which, for those of us who want under no circumstance to pick up snakes with our hands, this should come as a huge relief. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, read the longer ending later on. So this longer ending was added on to Mark's gospel later, probably in the 3rd or 4th century. So we're talking hundreds of years after Mark first wrote this account of Jesus. The bigger question, really, scholars and other people have been asking and debating is, did Mark mean to end his story this way? So was Mark about to finish it up and he was interrupted and therefore the ending just wasn't written? It's been said that maybe he was martyred before he could finish it. Or another thought is that Mark did write a longer ending, but that original ending has been lost. So we don't know. What we do know is this is the ending we have, and so our task today is to try to make sense of what we have of this ending. And what I want to invite you to do this morning it's going to take a little bit of work on your part, but see if you can forget as much as possible about what you know about Jesus' resurrection from the other gospel accounts. This might be one of the few times I ever plead with you to forget what you know in the Bible. Not because those stories of Jesus in the other Gospels after resurrection are important at all. But each of the Gospel writers has crafted their account of Jesus' life in a very intentional way. So Mark knows that this story continues and that there were resurrection appearances. But that's not the story that we get from Mark. So again, I want you to hear this morning the story as Mark writes it, or not how John writes it, not how Luke writes it, or Matthew writes it. Again, all essential, very important. But today I want to hear you hear this. I want you to hear it how Mark tells it. So with that in mind, let's look at Mark's account. Again, we're in verses 1 through 8. Verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Okay, so Jesus was crucified on a Friday. Mark tells us he was hung on the cross around 9 a.m. And then around 3 p.m. in the afternoon, Jesus cries out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? And with that loud cry, then Jesus breathes his last. So it's somewhere around 3 p.m., which means evening is approaching, and which means the Sabbath is about to begin, the Jewish Sabbath. And so there's some urgency to get Jesus' body down from the cross before sundown and before the Sabbath begins. And so what happens is Joseph of Arimathea, this guy, comes on the scene. He gets permission to get Jesus' body. He purchases some linen cloth. The body of Jesus is taken off the cross. It's wrapped in this cloth. And then it's placed in a tomb cut out of rock. And there was these three women who were watching this happen. The death and the burial, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. And so now our passage begins again with these women. So the Sabbath is now over, meaning it's probably Saturday evening. So the Sabbath would have ended at sunset. And these women go to buy spices so they can anoint Jesus' body. So because commerce and all the activity would have ceased on the Sabbath, this is the first time after Jesus' burial when it would have been probably possible to purchase these spices. And these spices, think of these as kind of a liquid perfume, which would have been put on a corpse as both a mark of respect and to keep the corpse fresh for as long as possible. Verse 2. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? So again, it's the first day of the week, Sunday morning, it's just after sunrise, and the women are now going to do what they didn't have time to do on Friday because of the Sabbath, which was anoint Jesus' body. And the scene almost kind of has a little bit of humor to it, almost sounds a little bit humorous, because as they're walking, they realize, oh, there's this huge stone that's blocking the entrance of the tomb, which at least the two Marys saw just a couple days earlier, this stone put there. They should have realized that, you know, they're not going to be able to move it. So they made all these preparations and yet forgotten about this massive stone. And here's what I want you to notice. These women are not going to find out if a man they saw killed just a couple days earlier and saw buried has been raised from the dead. These women are going to anoint a dead corpse with perfume. And stop and think about this for a second. Jesus has told his disciples in Mark's gospel several times, at least three times, I'm going to be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Which means probably Jesus said it more times. I'm going to die, and 3 days later, rise from the dead. So Jesus has been killed on a Friday. It's now Sunday, so it's the third day. And you'd think that maybe at least one or two of the disciples might say, it's the third day. I wonder if we should just check things out, just to see, you know, if by chance, I don't know, what's going to hurt? Maybe he did rise from the dead. But no, nobody's doing that. None of the disciples are there. And the three women aren't going there just in case. They're going there to anoint a dead corpse. And here's the reason why there weren't disciples there. Okay, are you ready? Because dead people don't rise from the dead. Let me say that again. Dead people don't rise from the dead. And sometimes you hear people maybe say today, well, of course, we modern people know this. We know that the dead don't rise from the dead. But back then, they were more superstitious. They didn't know all the things we know about science and medicine today. But what they're forgetting is that people then didn't believe in physical resurrection. So there was a couple thoughts, like Greek culture, which would have been influenced at this time, or starting to. The hope was not physical resurrection. It was the Greek culture, after someone dies, the soul is liberated from the body, and that soul then escapes this physical world to a non-physical world, which, as we talked about, sounds a little bit like sometimes how Christians talk about it now, but that's not the Christian hope. That's what the Greeks thought. And that's not what Jews thought. So Jews did believe in a physical resurrection, but that physical resurrection was going to happen one day, like when the entire world was renewed, everyone would be resurrected at the end of the age. So they didn't have a concept for a single individual rising from the dead. So go back with me to these three women. Because if we're going to understand how they react, we need to understand that they are not going to the tomb to see if Jesus was raised from the dead. They're going to anoint a dead corpse. Dead people don't rise from the dead then or now. Verse 4. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. So let's take a second and try to get our minds kind of a picture where we're at. We read that Jesus was put in a rock-cut tomb, so that apparently belonged to Joseph, this Joseph of Arimathea. This is very likely probably a family tomb that belonged to Joseph rather than an individual burial place. So these tombs, and apparently you can go and see some that are still around today, they would have contained several chambers with shelves. So you would have entered into it by a tunnel, and then you would have been various places that maybe, you know, dozens of bodies could be buried there. So when we read that the women entered the tomb, right now they're in the entrance to the tunnel. They're just going into this. And when they enter, they see a man standing inside the tomb, dressed in a white robe, a young man, Mark tells us. Who is this young man? It doesn't say angel, it says young man, but like everything about this young man has all the marks of an angel. He's wearing a white robe. It must be a brilliantly white robe because it can be seen just after sunrise in this dark tomb. That young man is seated, which is a position of authority, authoritative teacher. He's on the right side, which would be the side of authority. And the young man gives commands. So in other words, like this isn't some random guy who was walking around that Sunday morning and noticed that the stone was away and thought he'd check it out and they bump into him. No, this is clearly an angel. And we read that the women are alarmed. But that word, it doesn't capture what Mark's saying here in the Greek. The Greek word is really a powerful mixture of shock and fear. They're not alarmed. They are shocked and they are scared. Again, remember, these women are not going to anoint a dead corpse. This encounter is totally unexpected. The stone is unexpected. The encounter of the young man is unexpected. Verse 6, don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Now this whole tragic scenario we've seen turns on this, in Greek one word, in English three words, he has risen. So these women, they witnessed Jesus' death and they witnessed Jesus' body laid on this probably shelf in the tomb. And now they are the witnesses to the empty tomb. A couple things to notice here. Remember, at this point, the women are in the tunnel of this tomb, which kind of helps us understand this line, see the place where they laid him. So they had entered, but then he has to show them again the exact spot where they would have laid Jesus. And secondly, this phrase, he has risen. Really, a better translation is he has been raised. And it's a subtle difference. It's one of them is an emphatic passive. And that's what the Greek word is. It's not that Jesus rose, it's that Jesus was raised, has been raised. And it's subtle, but I think it's worth noticing. Jesus' dead body is raised, has been raised by God. God the Father, the same God who at Jesus' baptism, at the beginning of this story, says, this is my son, the beloved. This is the same Father who Jesus was constantly praying to throughout his ministry, including just a few nights before when he had prayed this prayer of anguish in Gethsemane. Everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. In other words, Jesus prays, Father, my soul is in anguish about what is about to happen. Is there another way? Everything is possible with you. Everything is possible, and yet I put my faith in you. I am obedient to you, not that I will, but what you will. It's an incredible and shockingly vulnerable prayer by Jesus. And the same Father to whom Jesus will cry out unto the cross, from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? That is the God who raised Jesus from the dead. Here's why I think this is worth noticing. The Jesus we see in Mark's gospel, we get this very human portrayal. So other gospels help us fill in other details that we know, get a more full picture of, for example, the divine side of Jesus, but Mark really, really gives us a picture at times of the human Jesus, of Jesus in anguish, asking the Father, is there another way? And apparently hearing back, no. But amidst the fear and anguish and feeling of abandonment, Jesus moves forward in faith and obedience, throwing himself at the cross in faith that the Father would not abandon him to the grave. And he did not. The Father is faithful to his promises. The Father is utterly to be trusted. We need the human side of Jesus because we have moments when we're scared, when we cry out in anguish to God, there's got to be another way. Everything is possible. Take this cup from me. We need this prayer because when darkness falls around us, as it did on Jesus while he died, and we feel abandoned, amidst all that, we remember God was faithful to the Son. God was faithful to his promises, and therefore the promises will hold for us, his children. Verse 7, but go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. So my two favorite words in this passage are in this verse. Go tell his disciples and Peter. Those are my two favorite words. Did you catch that? Go tell his disciples and Peter. It's like me saying to my wife, go tell our kids and Isaac. Like, Peter is one of the disciples. Like, why single him out? Go back with me a couple days here. Jesus is arrested in the garden, and once that happens, what do the disciples do? They desert him. They flee. You imagine with me, you're at your greatest moment of need. You become sick, and you're in intensive care in the hospital, and the people whom you most trust, most depend on, the people throughout your life you have held nothing back from, invested your whole life, abandon you. They desert you at your greatest hour of need. And when the doctor calls your own brother and asks for directives, when it looks like you're about to die, he says, you got the wrong number. I don't know who you're talking about. When you're back on your feet again, what's the first text message you send out? You fair weather, backstabbing, selfish, no good traitors that abandoned me in my greatest hour of need. Maybe that's not what you send, but maybe the thought comes. It's not Jesus' message, is it? What's the message Jesus sends back? Go tell my disciples and Peter that I'm going to Galilee and I will meet them there. Meaning, despite your utter failure at my greatest hour of need, all has been forgiven. All has been restored. And make sure Peter knows that. Go tell Peter. Go tell the one that failed most spectacularly, the most publicly. Make sure Peter knows all is well. You see what a word of hope and grace this was for the disciples and us today. You see what Jesus is doing? He's forgiving them before they even repented. He's forgiving his disciples so that they can repent. You see the grace here? And not only that, like, who's going to go on to be the leader of this church? It's Peter. The one who's most failed, most spectacularly, is now the one that is best equipped to lead this new movement. You know what that means? That not only can you be a spectacular failure and be forgiven, you can become uniquely qualified for the mission of Jesus in this strange and upside down kingdom. So brothers and sisters, with this word of hope and assurance, go forth now to your ham dinner and Easter egg hunt. So if Mark isn't going to give us a resurrection appearance, at least end the story here, right? This isn't the worst ending. He doesn't stop there, though, does he? We got one more verse. Verse 8. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Do you hear that? Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. The end. That's it. That's the end. What a strange way to end a story, a gospel account. It's abrupt. It's particularly abrupt in the Greek. It ends with just the word for, which is not totally unprecedented, but pretty rare for a story to end that way. But more than that, it's not just abrupt, it's troubling. So stop and think about this ending. Remember, instructions have been given to these women to go and tell that the tomb is empty. Now remember the instructions I gave you at the beginning of the sermon. Forget everything you know about the resurrection accounts. The story ends, what are you thinking right now? Like, what are you feeling right now? These women are fleeing. They're terrified and they're silent and they're not passing on the message. What are you feeling? The most central and urgent message that Jesus is not dead but alive has been entrusted to these women, and they say nothing to anyone. Something in you should probably be screaming out, no, it can't end this way. It doesn't end this way. The story can't end this way. Someone's got to go announce that the tomb is empty. This whole time, the reader of Mark's story, the reader thinks this story is about somebody else. And now it's as if Mark brings us to this incomplete ending of a story where it looks like all have failed. The disciples have abandoned Jesus. The women have failed their instructions and fled in terror and silence. And Mark now turns to us, to you and to me, and says, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You've been there the whole time. You witnessed all this just like the women. You witnessed more. You were there at Jesus' baptism when God identified Jesus as the Son. They weren't there. You saw the miracles. You saw the healings and the calming of the storm and the feedings of the thousands. You saw when Jesus declared, when Peter declared Jesus the Messiah. You saw the triumphant entry on Palm Sunday to Jerusalem. You saw the sham trial. You saw Jesus die on a cross. And now you have been witness to the empty tomb. What are you going to do? It's as if this moment, this whole time, we thought this story was someone else's story. And we realize Mark is looking at us and you and me and saying, what are you going to do? This is your story. See, Mark wrote this a few decades after the actual event. Mark knows the story doesn't end this way. Mark's original audience, they know the story doesn't end this way. The women cannot have kept silent. We know that the message got out. That's not Mark's concern here. That's not how Mark ends his story. See, Mark is not some kind of unbiased historian telling you about events. Mark has an agenda. Mark has very carefully crafted this story about Jesus. And there's all kinds of things that he could have added about Jesus' life or that he could have left out. He was very intentional about what he chose. And when I say a story, I mean a true story, but this is a story. And Mark has an agenda. He wants to force you into a position where you have to make a decision. You've seen all this unfold. You have seen the enthronement of Jesus on the cross and the vindication of his lordship by his resurrection by the empty tomb. What are you going to do? Jesus reigns as king now. Whether you acknowledge or not, Jesus reigns in kings as king. What are you going to do? You have to make a decision. That's a different ending than we're used to hearing on Easter morning. It's a stark ending. It's not, well, isn't this wonderful? Let's go eat ham and have Easter egg hunt. And by the way, both of which I plan to do this afternoon, not criticizing either one of those things. But please, please recognize that what is at stake today is so much bigger. It's so much higher than that. Mark is looking at you and me and saying, what are you going to do? It's in your hands. We have one of two choices. We can close the book. We can exit this story. It's an old story written for people long ago. We can close the book, or we can open back up. We can go to Galilee. That's what the instructions were, weren't they? Go to Galilee because Jesus is going ahead of you and you will see him there just as he said. So why Galilee? Well, remember, a few weeks ago, when I preached on the first chapter of Mark, we looked, that's where Jesus launched his mission. That's where he announced the kingdom, the gospel, the good news, that the time had drawn near. Repent and believe the good news. Galilee is where this whole story begins. And hear me, this is brilliant. It's like Mark is folding the story back on itself. Did Mark intend to end his gospel this way? I'm not sure. But Mark was a brilliant storyteller. And I wouldn't put it past him. I'm not quite sure. Mark is a brilliant storyteller. And the invitation here, with the way we have it, is to the reader, okay, you're not satisfied with the story ending here, with silence and fear? Well, then go to Galilee and proclaim the empty tomb. It's, you know this story doesn't end this way. Go out and proclaim it. Jesus the Nazarene has risen. Jesus said he was going to meet his disciples after he was raised from the dead in Galilee. Go proclaim this news. So it's that, go proclaim the empty tomb, but it's also go back to Galilee because this is where the story began. This is where Jesus first called his disciples. This is where Jesus launched this kingdom. This is where Jesus is teaching what it means to follow him. And by going back to the beginning, it's like we're going to now learn again how to follow the risen Jesus. We've read the story once, and we've made a decision. We're going to go back to Galilee, and now we're going to learn again. What does it mean to follow the risen Jesus? Mark's story ends with this invitation to Mark's readers, including us today, that the beginning in Galilee is our new beginning. And actually, that's exactly what we're going to do here. As a congregation, in a couple weeks, few weeks, we're going to go back to Galilee and start at the beginning of Mark's gospel, and we're going to go through it. That's going to be our spring and summer series is going to be on the gospel of Mark. Have you utterly and spectacularly failed? Good news. You are uniquely situated to be one of Jesus' disciples. You are the and Peter. You're the one that Jesus is in some ways specifically calling to, because his kingdom, those who fail most spectacularly and publicly can carry forth the mission. Not only that, they're uniquely qualified to carry forth the mission. Think about Paul the Apostle. Forgiveness is waiting for you there. Go to Galilee, enter this great story, and begin your story anew. Or maybe you see the empty tomb and you're scared, you're fearful. And you realize the implications and the stakes of this empty tomb are way higher than you thought. You're scared. Go to Galilee. You're in good company. You are in the company of women who are bewildered and scared and don't know what's happened, but they saw an empty tomb. They saw the empty tomb. And we know those women must have overcome their fear because word did get out. Jesus was risen. Are you fearful because you realize Jesus is asking you to abandon your old story, your old life, and begin a new story, a new life as his disciple? Are you alarmed that this story is one that is looking at you and saying, what are you going to do? Go to Galilee. Go look and learn what it means to follow Jesus. Are you skeptical of the empty tomb? It's understandable. Dead people don't rise from the dead. Not then. Not now. Go to Galilee. You see, the way the Christian faith works so often is that do what the young man says. Set out, go to Galilee, and see for yourself. So often is only after we set out in obedience and trust that our eyes are open and we see the risen Jesus. Go to Galilee. However you find yourself, go to Galilee. Jesus will meet you there.